What's going down, podcast listener? Welcome back to the Symbiosis Now podcast. I'm Tyler Colombaro, and I'm the host of the show. And on this show, we like to have a good conversation. Every episode, guaranteed. All in hopes of inspiring you to get out there and have your own open conversations with a friend, a family member, or maybe even your enemy. Each episode, we star a special guest where we have an in-depth, action-packed, often intellectual, spiritual, practically psychedelic, and all-inclusive types of conversation. And we have a good fucking time with it. So folks, you can find us online. We're the Symbiosis Now Network, where there's some links to the podcasts, plural podcasts, because we have a couple others underneath the network blanket. And without further ado, let us voyage into the yonder of conversation with our very special guest on the Symbiosis Now podcast. Folks, we're here with Sean Patterson, the guitarist of the band Vices. He's the beverage director over at the Wake House in Reedley. He has decades of experience. Decades, am I wrong? Of experience with booze, alcohol for sure.
Started in 2009, so yeah, I'm going into my third decade.
You're truly a badass bartender, in my opinion, and I've heard it from others, and everybody that has ever seen you at the bar feels the same way, bro.
Thank you, I appreciate that, man. And a few sips of Lafroy again, and woo!
Cheers to that, bro. Oh, hell yeah. Ah. He knows his beers, he knows his spirits, he knows his drinks, he knows a lot. And I have been blessed with the honor and opportunity to be trained by him at the bar. And I've come a long way because of this guy. And I've been wanting to have him on the podcast for some time. He's been down for some time. The issue was, not the issue, but the predicament was, is that I had had a baby and I didn't want to have people at the house on physically at the podcast for a while. But now that time is up. The ban has been lifted temporarily. And Sean has something that he wants to share with us. He was telling me that he had to wait all this time, months, we're talking maybe a year, that we've been waiting, 9 months, to talk about something that you wanted to get off your chest. And I feel like maybe we should just jump right into it.
Yes. Yeah, we should definitely jump into it. So listening to your previous podcast, something that comes up a lot is you ask people if they've seen anything in the skies, if they've had any experiences. And the second I heard that, I was like, oh, dude, I got a story for you.
Oh, gosh. I'm excited. With this Lafroig in my hand, I feel super stoked to hear about what you're talking about. But where do we begin?
I believe the year 2000. Either 99 or 2000.
Okay.
I graduated high school. I was playing in a band. And me and my band guys, for whatever weird reason, we wanted to find a haunted house. So we followed every rumor, every story, every myth that we could, and it led us to a house that my dad once lived in. He told us stories about this house when we were kids. He told us about how he would be sitting in the living room, and one side of the living room would be super cold while the other side super hot. He would go to bed at night and he would hear people breathing in his ear. He would hear women giggling. My dad smoked a lot of weed.
So perhaps he was tripping on a good one. But
serious, bro. So it was always really hard to tell, like, what was fact and what was fiction with him. Or, you know, like, memories not really that great. One story always stuck with me. In the kitchen of this place, one afternoon, he comes home, ready to cook some food, goes into the kitchen, sees that there's some blood on the floor. He's thinking his roommate cooked, probably spilled some steak blood or something on the ground. So he cleans it up, thinking, like, dude needs to clean up after himself. So he confronts him later on that night. And the guy starts laughing. He's like, Cliffy, don't clean that up. He's like, why not? He's like, it'll just go away on its own. It's going to be there again tomorrow afternoon, and it'll be gone by the night. Sure as shit, my dad goes and checks the next day. There's blood on the floor. Tests the scientific method, walks away, comes back that evening, gone. Again, my dad smoked a lot of weed.
So he was the one that would tell you the story, or you would witness it yourself as well?
No, he told me these stories.
Okay.
So after we visited multiple houses and we didn't find anything, nothing even remotely haunted, I asked my dad about that house. He's like, oh, yeah, if you're looking for haunted houses, it's just right there, right off Cherry Street in Porterville.
What?
And he described it as a duplex. So the downstairs apartment, you go in through the front door. He lived in the upstairs apartment that went from the side door. It's just stairs that went straight up. So we go there that night. We get to the front door. It was a Friday night. I'll always remember these 3 days. Friday night, we go, we find the house, we look at it, it's condemned, it's all shut down. We go up to the front door. It's got padlocks, it's boarded up, there's no getting in. So we walk around the side, we take a look, not a bad idea. We walk around the side, we take a look, and same thing. Big old panel of wood on the side of the house with a big old padlock on it. And we're thinking like, you know, we're not gonna do a B&E, we're not breaking into anywhere.
Right.
So we're ready to just call it a bust.
Right.
Guys start walking away, and I'm just thinking, like, I don't know. I've got a feeling about that. I just got a feeling. And I walked up to that padlock. I turned it. It was unlocked.
It was fake locked, right? Like, yeah. It made you think it was locked.
Dummy locked.
Yeah,
it was dummy locked. I was like, dude, guys, we're in. Let's go. So we go into this house and make our way up the stairs, and we're kind of freaking out because we're thinking, like, there's no way we're going to get in. There's just no way. Go up the stairs, just like my dad described it. You go to the top of the stairs, to the right, there's the kitchen. To the left, there's the living room. Beyond the living room was his bedroom. So we explored. We looked for the blood in the kitchen, but he said it was there in the afternoon and it was gone by night. So no blood. I don't even know if that story's true. But everything else was so far in terms of the layout of the duplex. So he lived there. That right. much was definitely
the whole story wasn't made up.
Right.
If there was any part made up.
So one of the stories that he told was his bed, next to his bed, he had a chair that he would use as like a nightstand. He would smoke his last cigarette at night, put it out in the ashtray, and some mornings he would wake up. The ashtray would be flipped upside down. There was a bed and a chair in that room. It was one of those old wire, like, mattress. It wasn't even a mattress. It was just like a wire frame that a mattress would sit on.
Yeah.
And I wondered, I was like, is that the same bed? Is that the same chair? Because there's no furniture in there. This place has been condemned. There's nothing.
Right.
Pardon me. Then we all think we hear a noise. We all panic and freak out and go running out of there.
How many of there are you?
It was me, my drummer, my singer, and I think my brother.
So like 3 or 4 people
with you?
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
And you all so heard something. That's when you know one of you ain't tripping, if you all heard something.
Well, here's the thing.
Like, yo.
Here's the thing. We're already like pumped up on adrenaline. We're panicking. We didn't think we were going to get in. This is the first like really kind of spooky feeling house we've been into. So, I mean, like, adrenaline's high. Energy's high. Heart rate's high. Everything. I don't think we were thinking very clearly. So the next day, I wonder, what did we actually hear? What did we hear? So one of my friends, he did turntables in our band.
Okay.
He missed out on the first night. He's like, dude, I heard the house was like crazy scary. I was like, I don't know, honestly. I mean, the sound could have been anything. Could have been anything. It's an old building. It's not insulated well. It's, you know, single pane windows. So we go back the next night just to kind of check it out. The vibe is very different. You know, I'm more comfortable because I've been there, so I'm not as freaked out. But I notice off in the distance the sound of a semi-truck going by, and when it crossed over the railroad tracks, it made this huge loud sound. And because it's an old house and thin windows, I wonder, did we hear something like that?
Right. Ricocheting somehow weirdly through the city.
Yeah.
Or towards you, yeah.
But he's panicking. He's freaking out. Right. And I'm like, I don't know. I've been here. It's not as exciting and thrilling the second night.
Right.
We hang out, and again, uneventful. We end up taking off. Third night, one of my friends, she heard how freaky this house was, and she wants to check it out. I kind of have like this adrenaline dump feeling, like I'm just over it. I don't really want to go.
You've already like gotten all excited and nervous at the same time going there a few times. It's like, okay, well, nothing's gonna happen tonight either, most likely, right? In your head.
Yeah. Have you had that adrenaline dump feeling? You know what that feeling
is? I didn't know what you meant. That's why I was describing it, what you mean by adrenaline dump, because I get what you mean. Mm. I was like trying to verify that's what you meant, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like tired and exhausted.
Yeah.
Like you've been up and hyped up, and you're just
you crashed off of all the adrenaline. Yeah. Like pretty much.
Yeah. So come Sunday, I feel awkwardly out of it. I don't want to go back to this house. I don't even think it's haunted. I just think it's a creepy old house, like many old houses are. And, you know, your imagination can picks up and takes over. What I was thinking was going on. But my friend Kate really insisted, and she wanted to go. I'm going to use her name. I kind of left out everybody else's name intentionally. I'll tell you why. We'll circle back to that. We show up at this house somewhere around between 9:30 and 9:45. We go in.
In the daytime or night?
At night.
Okay.
Yeah. Go in. I show her around. Tell her some of the stories. And then we sit at the top of the stairs, just wait to see if something happens. And by our estimation, we hung out there for what felt like 15, 20 minutes. But if time did get away from us, maybe we were there half an hour, maybe 45 minutes. But that, I mean, that just feels like a stretch. Completely uneventful. We go back into our truck. It's now nearly 1 a.m. And we can't explain it. I thought maybe her battery died and her clock reset back to midnight, but I was like, but even then it would be flashing at 12. Wouldn't be solid at like 12:45. There's right. no way we were there for 3 hours.
For sure.
Just no way.
For sure.
She drives me home. I live less than a mile away. I get back to my place and I check my clock. You know, this is before everybody had cell phones.
Right.
Yeah. And I check my clock and sure shit, it's 1 a.m. We can't explain it. We have no idea. I call her up. I'm like, what happened? How did we lose 3 hours? This doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Go to bed. Next morning, I wake up to my dad coming and sitting next to me, puts his hand on my chest and asks me very seriously, Sean, is there anything about last night you want to tell me? I was terrified. I had no idea what he's talking about. And I had to ask, like, what do you mean? He's like, well, I know you went to that house last night. Is there anything you want to tell me? I was like, I mean, it was really uneventful. Nothing. It was weird. However, we ended up being there for 3 hours. We don't know. We can't explain it. I was like, that was the only weird thing that happened. But other than that, nothing. He hands me a newspaper. That house burnt to the ground shortly after we left.
What?
The fire started somewhere around 1 a.m. Firefighters were putting it out till about 5 a.m. To this day, we have no idea what happened.
You didn't smoke stogie or something like that?
We were completely sober.
Damn.
Completely sober. Not a drink, not a joint, not a cigarette. To this day, we have no idea what happened. And the reason I told you I wanted to talk about this is because it's still a mystery.
Right.
I want to know if anybody knows anything about it or has the means to find out what happened. Because it's haunted me not knowing. It's just too fucking weird, dude. I leave at like 12:45. The house catches on fire at 1 a.m. I mean, was somebody scoping out the house, watching, waiting for us to leave, and hopefully, like, we get blamed for it?
Oh, shit.
Her dad was the fire chief.
Really?
Yeah, he was the fire chief.
Really?
He asked her the same line of questioning. He wanted to know, like, what were you guys doing there? What happened?
Holy shit. That's a twist of the story. Her dad was the fire chief.
Fire
dude.
Chief.
Holy crap.
Mm-hmm. So there it is. There's the mystery. What happened to that house? Was it a ghostly apparition that caught fire? Was it a bank trying to claim some insurance? To this day, it's just an empty lot. Nothing there.
What if someone else like was like there while you were there, and they were like, "Fuck, man, we're gonna burn this fucking house down tonight," and they're like waiting for you to leave, and as soon as you were gone, they're like, "All right, they're fucking gone. Let's light this fucking shit on fire!" Like, who knows?
That's exactly what I thought. Yeah. I mean, that seems like the most rational explanation.
Or like just saying like word of mouth travels fast, especially like you said before cell phones. I know now with cell phones, but like. Dude, like, now it's more like Snapchat videos of, like, where, you, look at where I am, but nobody usually asks, where are you actually? I want to actually go there. They just want to watch you doing it or experiencing whatever you're recording and sending them.
Right.
But there was an incentive back in the day to, like, want to go to the haunted house, right? So what if one of your boys told someone and it was like, you only told one person, but they did slip it to someone else. And then someone else was like, oh, there's a haunted house that's, like, vacant. We could go fuck with that house. Who knows, right? Like, you know, in a matter of days, literally, right, during that time.
I mean, I think one of the most rational theories that I have is it's not an uncommon story for old, condemned buildings, whether they're commercial or residential, they have sudden fires when they haven't sold in decades.
Right.
And they've been sitting there and somebody collects some kind of insurance check.
Right.
That's an old story. Everybody knows that that happens.
Right.
Did that happen there? It seems likely. It just seemed the timing is so odd. Mm-hmm. Everything about it is just odd. What happened to that 3 hours? Mm-hmm. I talked to some paranormal investigators and I told them my story. And I almost always tell the story, and I guess I'm just nervous that I'm on a podcast and I didn't open it up the same way, but I tell people I've never really had a paranormal experience.
Right.
I don't know what it's like. I want one.
Right.
I've never had a UFO experience. I want one.
Yeah.
You know, I just crave that validation that these things are real, right?
Right. I hear.
So when I talked to a paranormal investigator and I told him about it, he said, you know, you actually did experience some paranormal phenomenons. There was something that he called, make sure I get this right, time differential experience or something.
Like the time warp fucking thing. Yeah, dude.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
where
yeah.
time goes. Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, when I
differently.
Explained the adrenaline dump feeling that I had, he said that was another, like, paranormal fatigue is what some people call it, I think. And maybe true.
Right, but, or they could be playing on this, on just normal humans in a state of fear for a couple of days, end up coming down, and like they're just like manipulate. I don't know. Some people are weird. Like psychics are often weird, and they're like trying to spew some bullshit and sell this fact to your own self, and you even trick your own self into being like, maybe they're right, you know?
But I, you know, I'm so prone to confirmation
right.
bias, so
right.
prone to it that I have to be skeptical and I have to look right. for like the rational explanations.
What about the girl that you were there with? What does she feel about it? What does she think happened? Same thing as you?
So I brought it up to her again recently, and it's something that we hadn't talked about. This happened 99, 2000, something like that.
Right.
So it's even before the digital age of newspapers. So I can't find that newspaper clipping online because they didn't start posting stuff online until years later.
Not for like a smaller time paper, right? Maybe the
right.
New York Times or Rolling Stone, things that have been around for a long time there you could find in some archive somewhere, like
yeah.
they've updated, but I get what you mean. Some
Porterville doesn't
yeah,
have that kind
yeah,
of budget.
Porterville, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so we met up earlier this year, and I brought it up to her. I was like, hey, you remember the house? She was like, I do remember the house. You remember losing time, right? She was like, oh, yeah. You remember it burnt down the next day. She was like, oh, my God, I forgot all about that. And then, you know, she brought up the stories, talking to her dad, and we were trying to get some information. We were trying to figure out how can we solve this mystery? And she started getting into archives and some of the history of Porterville. There's a guy named Jeff Edwards who just recently passed away, but he was Porterville's like unofficial Porterville historian, and he kept records of Porterville's history through photography. A large portion of his collection burnt down in the library fire in Porterville. A lot of records and archives. But there's still people that are on the board of like the Porterville Museum that keep a lot of history. And many of those guys are former police officers. Many of those guys have resources. And again, that's another reason I wanted to bring this up. And I don't mind throwing her name out there, is because we want to know what happened. What actually happened? What's the official report? Fire investigators, they do an investigation to find out, was it arson? Was it accidental? What was that report?
Right.
What happened?
Yeah, right.
I want to know. But I was so scared for the longest time to even bring it up because I didn't want to be implicated in a fire.
Right, yeah, right. Because it's like, well, you were there. And it's like, no, but no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying this is really confusing for me. But how do you go to the cops and be like, yeah, so like I was in this house, but then there was a fire shortly after I left the house, but it wasn't me.
So you were the last one to see it standing.
Yeah, come here for a second, you know, like, oh, dude. That's a pretty crazy story though, but like I'm really interested in the time warp part of it. That's
mm-hmm.
what's a trip to me, because it's like you're just sitting at the top of the staircase, sober as a rock, and time just like transpires way faster than it felt like it did, you know?
We weren't even talking. We were just sitting there, just
mm-hmm.
looking around, hoping for something. We may have asked like, are there any spirits that want to communicate?
Mm-hmm.
Wait and listen. Hope something
dude
happens.
it's like you know how people say like there's a place in the world or the universe where like things just are like a time warp, like things exist differently. Like in a video game, I feel like that's something that's usually worked into it. Like you go to this one place and it's just different. Or like if you go to the edge, there's a boundary and it like shoots you back to the middle or something. Mm-hmm. But like there's these spots where time maybe does exist differently. Like just right there above the staircase and down to the ground, maybe just that one spot. Like they say, like Santa Cruz, the mystery spot, even right. though there's a lot of like, I think they're just playing tricks on us. There's some weird shit about that spot. Like it may be just an illusion. Okay. And I think a lot of it is, but some of it's like, that is weird though. Why does the tree grow like that? It's looking kind of weird. Like, you know what I mean?
And I've never been to the mystery spot, but I've heard things about it. And I've worked with an illusionist. I've worked with a magician.
Right.
And so I'm really skeptical of right. so many things.
Right.
You know, when you stand behind the curtain and you see how these things are done, most of the time it's laughable.
Right.
Absolutely laughable. But from where the audience is sitting, it's amazing. It's spellbinding.
Right, right, right.
It's yeah. mind-blowing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So being in the audience of a place like the Mystery Spot, I would be like, I would have to wonder, what's the trick here?
Right. You but know? Then you're looking at it, and then they're like, okay, let's go on to the next spot. So you can't really, like, you just be left in awe and wonder because you continue with the tour.
Yeah.
Like someone's bringing you around and showing you and telling you the history of how this spot was found and what is weird about this spot. They, like, take a board and they put it, and it looks like it's literally going up in elevation, but they put, a cue ball on it, and it rolls uphill. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just because the platform we're standing on is crooked, and we're on a slope of a hill, and it's just the way that it feels for your mind. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. Someone could probably – I bet you there's a YouTube video of someone debunking each part of it or something, right?
Probably.
But I like to believe, even if it's not true, because it's fun, yeah, because it's harmless.
Right.
But when we start talking about, like – entities or like aliens, I'm a very skeptical person for sure. This podcast is skeptical. We have guests like the local skeptic, who's one of my favorite guys to have on, because we are very skeptical about the narratives that are sold to us, the opinions that people really push out there, false footage, falsified evidence of footage and shit like that. Like too many UFO videos have I been like, bro, on TikTok, I'm like, bro, this is it. I send it to everyone, like all my UFO guys, right? And I'm like, dude, and I'm like tripping. I'm like, wait, when they see this, they're gonna message me back. I'm like waiting, because I'm like, I gotta know, and I'm rewatching the video, and I'm watching the video, and I'm like, dude, I can't explain this one. And I look in the comments, and someone always just rips the fucking comment section to pieces, like, no, bro, it's this kind of tower. Google it, look it up, and sure enough, you look up like this tower, I forget what it's called, but it looks like a UFO in the sky with a beam shooting down. But it's just a certain type of light that they have in certain areas. Like for ag, for like big scale agriculture, sometimes they put that up, or sometimes it's for like just it's like a city light, like kind of like how they have water towers, but it's more like a light. Like it's weird, but like there's always an explanation. But if you're not from right. there, if you don't know, you know, you're like, what's up with this shit right now? This looks like a real UFO. But there's so much of that. It's so overwhelming. And if I were not skeptical, I would just fall for every dumb fucking thing. And to this day, I feel like there's so much footage and there's so much controversy. I don't know how to feel about it. Same goes with ghosts and the theory that, you know, the supernatural. I feel very strongly that that is a thing. I've told stories on this podcast like with like weird situations where I felt like it was definitely a supernatural scenario. But do I believe that it was? I don't know. Right. Really, deep down, I don't really know if I really believe that.
And
but my fear was spiked in the moment. My adrenaline was off the chart in the moment. I thought for sure there was something supernatural going down in the moment.
See, and I think that's something that we all crave. We right. crave to know that there's something beyond ourselves. There's something beyond our existence. And whether it's aliens or it's life after death, you know,
it's God. It's whatever religion you follow and the creator of
I wonder
that.
If it's a bit narcissistic to believe
I feel
that
like you're right.
you know, we are eternal beings.
Yeah.
But maybe we are. I don't know. And we're not going to know until we die.
Right.
And nobody that's dead has ever come back and been like, yo, bro, I'm going to prove it to you. Yep, we're around forever. Where's that guy?
Right. How are we going to prove it?
Right. Exactly. But also, I mean, I was that kid that I loved cryptozoology. I loved paranormal encounters. I loved UFOs.
Right.
And I was all in. You know, the old Bigfoot footage. You
yeah.
know, the grainy video where he's walking all goofy and... You know, I was a kid watching that going like, oh my God, he's real. He's right there.
He's on camera.
The TV. Yeah. Oh, you can't fake that. That's Bigfoot. Totally fake. Yeah, bought into it. Hook, line, and sinker. But I mean, I'm 7 when I see that for the first time in my life.
But you can still, convince but there's all these like 50-year-olds that are like, they've seen it when they were seven, and they're still like, nope, that was for sure real. I know it. I saw it with my eyes on the screen, and they're super dedicated to it. But sometimes I feel like you said about narcissism, I think that sometimes people take it to the next level. They're like, no, I know something you don't know, even though that they know deep down that it's they don't even really believe it. They're still going to like be like, this is my thing. Like, yeah. I'm going to own this Bigfoot shit. And then sometimes, especially with I'm going to go there. I'm going to say like with religion, I feel like some people take it there till their deathbed and they maybe they realize, oh, you know, maybe I was a little wrong with the way that I approach things. Or maybe I took things too literal. Or maybe I didn't live up to the standard I thought I had set. But really, that's all just in your head. And I forgot where I was going with this.
Well, it becomes your identity.
It becomes like too locked in to who you are.
Right.
And for you to go back on that now, even if you're presented with evidence that is to the contrary, that you actually are like, wow, you know what? This is the one key to the lock that I needed to unlock this other aspect of this cultural identity that I have, this religious identity that I have, this socioeconomic identity that I have. But for me to go back on the way I actually feel means all of that what I did was a lie. But it's okay to like acknowledge that. That's how humans like really, I feel like, whatever you want to call, get to the next level of consciousness or whatever that may be, but is by accepting those things that like, oh, it shattered my worldview, but I have to recreate who I am. I don't want to recreate who I am, but you got to sometimes with new evidence, you know? And sometimes you have to ignore it, right?
That actually leads perfectly into vices. My whole identity was being a guitarist, being a rock star. That was it. That was everything. And when that band crashed and burned, I was wondering, who am I? What am I? What is my purpose? My purpose my entire life has been to aspire to this, and it's gone. What am I doing? It was hard, dude. That was the roughest part of the pandemic for me. Like, the lockdown was awesome.
Okay, let's back up then. So you were in Vices, this badass fucking metal band. Would you consider it metal? That's what I would call it.
Yeah, I call it alternative metal. Yeah. I tell people it's heavy enough. You can bang your head, but your girlfriend can sing along.
Yeah, it's nice. I like it, dude. V-Y-C-E-S, Vices. Mm-hmm. I looked it up on YouTube earlier. You got to check it out, listener. He's got a good couple songs out there. But when did you start that band, and then you went on tour like shortly after that? Because you guys probably dropped an album, right?
We formed in 2014.
Hello, everybody. This is Tyler Colombaro, the host of the Symbiosis Now podcast, as well as the host of the Cali Ag podcast, which is new. It is launching. It's ready for you to hear. Here's a little intro clip to get you enticed. I hope you can go check it out on Spotify and all the platforms out there. Check it out. Welcome to the Cali Ag Podcast. I'm Tyler Colombaro, and I'm the host of this podcast. This podcast will ultimately be an exploration into all aspects of California agriculture, from the crops, to the land, to the water. Listener, if you were not aware, the state of California provides an unquantifiable amount of produce to the world. We will feature guests on each episode that work and lead the agricultural trajectory and symbiosis within the state of California. So listener, join us. Tell your friends and tell a farmer about the Cali Ag Podcast.
My drummer, Russell Ray, him and I, we've been playing together for years. We've been through a slew of bands, and he was my road dog, man. Through thick and through thin, he's always had my back, I've always had his. And I had moved from LA to Fresno, where I met my wife, got married, and I was done. I told her, I was like, I'm done with rock and roll, but if Russell calls me, I'm taking that call.
Nice.
And she, you know, she was hoping I wouldn't get that call. I was secretly hoping I would get that call. Right. And when I did get that call, he told me Dave Neruzowitz, who was from this band Heart Set Self Destruct, we went and watched them open up for Filter, and I was blown away. I was like, oh my God, dude, we gotta get that guy. That's our guy. He sings, he screams, he plays guitar, he's a full-on front man. We had never had somebody that solid, and solid enough to take it out on the road. It's hard.
That's a lot to ask from a person.
So he calls me up and says, Dave's looking to start a new band. I was like, done. Let's do this. So 2014, we started writing, and we spent the whole year in the recording studio. We recorded, I don't know, 30 songs that year, and just picked out our best and put out our EP. But in that time, we're working on our branding, like getting our logo. We had to get our name copyrighted, and copywriting that name turned out to be a little tricky, hence the reason we had to spell it differently. There was another band named Vices out there.
Oh, shit.
Was really good at doing paperwork, but they didn't play any shows. They had no music out there. So we go back to the drawing board, and we're like trying to come up with band names, and Dave comes up with the idea, how about we just change the spelling? Like, what do you have in mind? V-Y-C-E-Z. I was like, yeah, change that Z to an S, and we're in business.
Right.
So that's how Vices started. So in that time, we then met Mark Kaplaski. Mark Kaplaski is one of the founding members of Breaking Benjamin. He lived right next to one of the guys, Evan Seidlitz, who was in our band, lived right next door to where he bartended. So he was a regular customer of his. Brought him in for some rehearsals, and at first he wasn't really on board. So like, okay, we tried out some other bass players. But then Mark came around and he wanted to be in the band. Great, dude, this is awesome. We got some star power in the band. But he's a phenomenal musician, just phenomenal musician. I have nothing but the greatest respect for Mark. When he came in, even with the simplest setup, just bass plugged straight into his amp, the best bass tone any of us had ever heard in a rehearsal. We're like, dude, you're the guy. So we had him track all the bass parts in the early recordings. And 2015 is when we started playing shows. We didn't hit the road yet, but what our strategy was, you know, places that'll have bands play and they don't pay them or anything, you tell them, well, you know, you're getting exposure. It's not exposure if there's nobody in the audience.
Right.
So the strategy is you buy on to big shows. A band that's going to have a draw, you buy on to that opening headlining slot. So you're right before the headliner when everybody's there. And that's what we did. We just piggybacked on bigger shows so that we got big audiences, so we could sell merch, so that we could get our music out there, start creating some fan base. So come 2016, we started our radio campaign, getting our songs into radio, and hit the road. And those first couple of tours sucked. But they were the best.
What do you mean, like, just hard, grueling?
Hard. I mean,
traveling and fucking waking up and playing. And
well, I mean, that was the fun part, was getting to hit the road, getting to travel, and knowing that you're going to be in a different city every day. It's cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
It's really cool.
Sounds epic.
You end up in some of these, like, hole-in-the-wall play. I want to make it really clear. I am not talking shit on this place. But when we saw we were playing a place called the Rusty Needle, we're like, oh no,
the infamous Rusty Needle Bar.
What's this gonna be like? And we go in and there's not even a stage. It's just this little hole. It's like literally like a hole in the wall, and you set up on the floor.
That's hilarious. And they probably did that on purpose, bro. They're like, we'll be a little hole in the wall venue.
Yeah, I think they pulled out the pool table so that the band could set up. But that was in, I can't remember if it was Salina, Kansas, but I know for sure it's in Kansas. It was one of the best shows. Hardly anybody there, but like those Kansas kids, when they come out, they come out to rock.
Yeah.
And getting to play for them the first time and seeing people, you know, that knew our songs from the radio.
Whoa.
Are coming out. I'm like, oh my God. And you know, our first tours, sometimes, you know, sometimes there'd only be like 20, 50 people in the audience, which is rough. In the beginning, you know, you want audiences. You want to be able to sell merch so that you can get to the next city.
Right.
You want to be able to eat. You want to be able to shower. But those Kansas kids loved us. On our first tour, we went to, I'm not going to say the name of the bands because I don't want to put them on blast, but we played this place. It was the Paramount Bar. Kevin Rome is the owner. Super cool dude. Shout out to Kevin Rome. It was the night the Cubs won the World Series. We had to wait to play the show until the game was over because our singer's from Chicago, and this was it. This is everything he's been waiting for. So Kevin, the owner, he invites us to come back behind the bar and take shots with him. I'm like, but at your bar? I'm like, bro, I bartend, man. I don't let anybody behind my bar. And he was like, no, dude, go back there, grab yourself whatever you want, bring me one too. I was like, you're the best.
Damn.
Well, back up a little bit. We show up at this place, and it's a tiny little stage. It's one of those galley-style bars, so it's just a straight rectangular room. So sound isn't great. The stage was this little tiny box that was elevated. There's no room for a whole band up there. So what we did is we set the drums up there like a drum riser, and then the band just played on the floor. Well, seeing the setup, the other two bands that we were on tour with took one look at it, were like, nah, we're not playing this place. We're like, so my singer comes back, like, guys, they're not going to play the show. What do you want to do? I was like, dude, I didn't drive all the way to Kansas to not play a show. We're playing the show.
Fuck yeah.
And yeah, that's what they
said. You're the headliner now then, right? Like, exactly. Right? If they bailed, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Well, there was a local band that played.
Great, I get you.
Great Big Giant Doom Machine. Best band name ever. I love these guys. They had a dude playing electric cello for bass. So cool, dude.
That is cool. What the heck?
Yeah, Chewy was the singer. Chewy? Am I getting that right? Yeah. Well, shout out to Chewy.
Shout out.
So they bowed out. Cubs win the World Series. The place gets packed. We sold all of our merch. They gave us not only our guarantee, but the other band's guarantee. Made a bunch of friends. People I still keep in touch with to this day. And we just kind of loved rubbing the other band's nose in it. Like, sorry, guys. I mean, yeah, it was only like 100 people, but they threw down. Absolutely threw down.
It was one that they shouldn't have missed, for sure.
Should not have missed.
Yeah.
But, you know, not every show was like that. Sometimes you did roll into places and they don't have a PA system, or they've got, like, really janky equipment. Sometimes you're getting shocked by microphones because there's bad grounding.
Holy shit.
One of our early shows.
What?
Oh, I forgot about this. They set up a makeshift stage in front of the bathrooms in this club. So people have to walk behind the stage to get to the bathrooms. And we got power cords running into outlets from behind the stage. Somebody tripped over an outlet, unplugged all the entire sound system, lights, everything dropped out in the middle of our show. We turn around and there's just some dude on his way to the bathroom going, sorry.
Fucking one plug, dude, just hella overloaded, huh?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, dude. Great plan, right?
Damn, bro. That sounds like some sketchy ass shit, though. But I bet you there's so many places that just they don't have an infrastructure for the type of shit that they sometimes sponsor. Mm-hmm. I know places that I could name that are like that.
Dude, this was in Southern California, too.
Damn.
I think that was in Anaheim. I think it was Anaheim. It's hard, dude. It's hard to remember all the places.
I bet you all the people that locally know that spot, they're like, yeah, that's how they get down, bro. They fucking have one plug and they plug everything into it, and it's a fucking terrible idea. But you know what? They do it, man. They party.
They gotta have a bathroom bouncer. If you haven't done it already, do it, guys. Get on board.
For sure. Especially for that. Just someone to guard the electricity. It's super important. This shit doesn't get unplugged, guys. Like,
so, oh, you brought up earlier, the video for Devil.
Right.
Yeah, yes. The one with the face paint, mm-hmm. and all of that. And I told you, I started telling you, we did it all guerrilla. And then we're like, wait, let's just talk about it on the podcast. So we had, like, essentially three locations. The director, he filmed it all on a digital camera that looks like a regular camera. And you know, in L.A., you've got to have permits to actually shoot video.
Right.
So to get around getting all those permits, he was like, well, it just looks like a regular camera. So I went down to the subway and just got some subway shots, got some, I guess it's like the B-roll of, you know, the area of Hollywood that we were in. And so he shot all of that separately. Then we shot at, Tiger Lab Studios. And that's where you see, like, the full band playing together. But everything else, where we're in the face paint and the girls running around, being chased by the dude, that was all, we just shot that all guerrilla style at Mark's apartment, because he lived right next door to where Evan worked. So late at night, there we are, we gotta keep it quiet because it's super late at night, there's tenants, everybody listening. So every shot that you see us, I mean, it looks like action. It looks like so much is going on.
Like, you guys are screaming and fucking stomping on the floor, jumping up and down.
But what's really happening is, like, all of us, that scene where we're walking and I'm walking all weird and stuff, you know, it's the director with a camera like this, and we're being super quiet. He's backing up just going, cool. looks so cool. He was so fun to work with, man. Every time he was getting something that he liked on camera, he's like, so cool. Looks so cool.
Yeah, dude, that's awesome. He could, like, see what it would be put together as afterward, like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ron Underwood. He's just a phenomenal director. I don't know if he still is, but he was like the go-to guy. So all the up-and-coming bands, if you're shooting a video in LA, Ron was the dude, and he just always backed up with work. Always backed up. Because he's great. He does great stuff. And he does it he's a one-stop shop, like, you know, most places are. But yeah, he's the guy.
That's fucking epic. Yeah, dude, I was watching your music videos and I was just tripping out. You look so good, and everyone does. It's so cool. It's fucking good music, bro, for sure. But I was just thinking about like how he would sometimes bring up at work, like how you were on tour and you bring up tour and how like rugged some spot was or whatever. Like you talked about how like you needed to wear boots somewhere because it was so fucking cold. Like, and it was like, what am I doing with Vans or fucking Converse on or some shit?
So that was my first tour, and we were in Casper, Wyoming. And
Just sounds cold, like, yeah. Just Casper, Wyoming. Wyoming sounds cold, and Casper, like, cold, like fucking ghostly cold.
So it's my buddy Matt Snell, he was like the only other guy on the tour that liked craft beer. Well, going through, I ran into an old friend who's now a master brewer, and but he does lots of German styles. And so, you know, I always love to poke at the guys that do the German styles. I was like, psh, you probably don't even brew a West Coast IPA, do you, bro? Just keeping everything traditional, aren't you, bro? And he's like, dude, I did my master thesis called Hop Monster. And he set me up with two growlers of it. And I was just holding on to him, waiting for that right moment. And there we are in Casper, Wyoming. And we got, like, drink tickets, and they've got Coors Light or something, whatever. And I'm not bagging on Coors Light, but I see Matt. He's got one, and he just doesn't look very happy. And I was like, dude, are you bummed because you're drinking Coors Light? He's like, I guess I'm happy to have anything at this point. I was like, how about a Hop Monster? And he's like, bro, he poured it out immediately. Let's go. So we go, and I pull it out of the trailer. I was like, it's not. Actually, it was in the back of the van. And, you know, we got the heater pumping, so, like, they're warm.
Right.
I was like, it's not cold. He's like, dude, just set it on the ground for a few minutes.
It's that cold.
Dude, the ground was frozen. And frozen solid. Set it down. It only took, like, 5 minutes to chill. But in that time, I'm freezing, dude. I'm standing in Converse. I'm basically wearing moccasins on a frozen ground.
Yeah.
It was stupid. Just absolutely stupid. I was like, I should have brought boots or extra socks or something, man.
Right.
So we set this beer down for like 5 minutes, and there we are chugging Hop Monster in his RV while everyone else is drinking Coors Light.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. The first ones were wild, but it was the later ones that really started picking up. You know, you start off in little bars and sometimes little clubs, and then eventually you're in full clubs, and you know the crowds are getting bigger. Next thing you know, you're in theaters, and then the theaters are getting bigger, and then the lineups of the bands are getting bigger. And I'm standing there sometimes going like, dude, I can't fucking believe I'm sharing the stage with the night we played with 10 Years and Fozzy. I mean, I walked by Chris Jericho. That guy's fucking huge, dude. It was intimidating. I don't think I'd ever been around a man that big. And I walked by and just go, fuck, dude. you made a career out of destroying people, and now you sing rock and roll. Fucking badass.
Badass, dude.
So badass. So, yeah, that was a wild one. That was, it's in Illinois. Shares the same name as like a popular black comedy club theater in New York. Apollo. It was the Apollo Theater. Yeah, where's that at in Illinois? Oh, there's going to be so many people hating on me right now because I don't remember where it's at.
So what happened then, though? Like, after, like, when did touring end? The pandemic? Is that when the wheels fell off of the touring? Or no, is you just, like, tour for a little while and then stop touring for a while? And then
It would always depend. You know, that first year, it would be like 2 and 3 week runs. And then I think we picked up like 3 of those the first year. And then the second year, that's when things got a little bit bigger. We went out on tour with Otherwise, and that's when we started getting into like the bigger clubs. But then on that run with Otherwise, we did a show with Power Man 5000, and for whatever reason, we just hit it off with them. Like, they were just so fun, so cool to be around. A lot of the guys were LA guys, so we that short circle of musicians and people kind of know each other through other people. And Power Man took us out on tour, and that Power Man 5000 tour was insane.
That's
dude.
Tight.
That's when we started getting into the big theaters, and that's when stuff really started like blowing up. The radio campaigns were doing well. That's when we started doing radio spots and going in doing acoustic sessions. A lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. Our last show was in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and that was Rock USA, and we got kind of lucky. That Of Mice and Men fell off the bill, because then we got that headlining opening slot. So fell off the bill, and we got to open up the show for Marilyn Manson, who was then opening the show for Rob Zombie. But
shit.
A storm rolled in, and they had to cancel Rob Zombie. So as soon as we were done, and Marilyn Manson's playing, and I'm going, dude, this is badass. You can see what looks like Armageddon coming from behind the stage. See lightning and clouds just billowing in. I was like, oh, dude, this is great. Marilyn Manson's bringing in the apocalypse.
That's so tight, bro. That sounds so epic.
So 29, that was our last show, and that was right before the pandemic hit. So obviously the pandemic hit, shut everything down, and unfortunately we didn't survive it at that point. You know, it was, like I said, it was soul-crushing. It was one of those where, what do I do now? You know, I'd been in this go mode of just, if I'm not on tour, I'm constantly working to save up money for tour or for recording studios. And if I'm not working, then I'm in my recording studio and I'm just writing as much music as I possibly can, just throwing as much at these guys, like whatever, just throwing whatever sticks to the wall, you know?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And once that ended, and then I'm in the pandemic and it's like, I'm not working, I'm not writing, I don't have a band, and even if I did, there's no shows. We don't know how long this is going to go.
No, seriously, yeah. How would anyone fucking know? Like, how long? Like,
yeah. And that was the time that like we're talking about something becomes your identity. That was my identity, and that had been my identity for decades since 2000 when I started my band. Well, even before that, my brother and I started our first band, Dysfunctional, in high school. He ended up taking off and playing with the other local band, Hostile. And then we ended up merging into a new band, 808. And just from the 90s all the way to 2020, that's all I did. That's all I aspired to. That's all I wanted. You know, getting into bartending was just a means to make money so that I could get back on the road, get out there with the band, get back in the studio.
Right.
And so that was the reinvention. I was like, okay, now I got to start taking this bartending thing seriously. And I opened up a restaurant in Porterville. Some people, they gave me their bar program. And I thought I knew what I was doing until I went to work at the Draycott in the Palisades, where it was intense, absolute intense bartending training. I had been bartending at that point for 11 years, and it was as though I had never poured a drink in my life. I knew nothing. And for a year straight, it was just Cocktail Academy 101. And that, that brings me to the Wake House. This is really my first opportunity to do something with all of this training that I got. And I told you before, it started with craft beer, and then craft beer evolved into craft cocktails.
Right.
And it's become my, you know, my new passion, my new obsession. I always want something new, something different, something, you know how it is because we work together. You know, there's sort of this spectrum where you know what's a safe drink. Like, okay, this is a crowd pleaser. But then right. You got to have something special. You got to have something challenging, something that's different. And it's for the people that don't want the same thing, that want something special and unique.
Right.
And coming out of music and wanting to create something special and unique, something creative, something that has its own identity, I'm now carrying that into cocktails. And the reality is, it's influences and inspiration from all places and pulling them together into making something that I believe is my own. But just like playing music, You're not going to play a note that anyone hasn't played. You're not creating something that somebody hasn't created. So sometimes you just find a new spin on what somebody else has done. Try to take it to another level. And sometimes take some risks and make some really bad cocktails. Like we tried that one yesterday.
Right.
And it's like, no.
That's not going to work. Yeah, that's not okay. Yeah. And, you know, I think that that's what has made you so successful and why people come to the Wake House and acknowledge the fact that the drinks are on point, that they're consistent, is because you've brought that to this place. And also these new ideas that you come up with, they are interesting because you know how to play with the base materials that are available. And then you also know how to bring new materials into the equation to make the other set of possibilities possible. I was talking about this recently on this podcast, and I want to say it was with James Long. We were talking about music. I shouted you out specifically because we were talking about music. But I also noticed, and I talked about in that episode, that like notes, music notes, there's so many of them that we call a note, right? And then there's versions of those notes, but that leaves you only limited with like, what, 20 or less notes, right? But how you arrange them, and depending on what instrument you play, it makes it beautiful or not. Well, I feel like the same thing goes with like cocktails. It depends on how much sweet, like sugar, are you adding? How much spirit, like alcohol, are you adding? How much bitter component are you adding? How much acid are you adding to make this perfectly balanced, blended cocktail, not just a drink? Right. Drink could just be poured, splash here, a little splash there, but boom, it's a tequila sunrise. But it's like, but there's some complexities that if you want it to taste on point and it to be something very palatable that you can consistently provide that people enjoy, they don't just like, oh, you know, it got me fucked up. It's like, they're like, oh my gosh, what is this? This is cool. This is different. Right. You bring that to the table, bro. And obviously it's taken trial and error over decades to get to that point. You know, yeah, and I stand back amazed being able to train with you because I'm just like, okay, this is what wisdom he's sharing, and he's not a gatekeeper of knowledge, and I really appreciate that, bro. You know.
Well, and you know, you've heard me mention Niko Novik before.
Yes.
Niko was very much that person. He loved to share knowledge, and he was so good at teaching, so good. And I think he hones in on the people that have passion.
Right.
And I love food. I love drinks. I love spirits. I love beers. I like complex flavors. I mean, I like, dude, a cheeseburger's fucking delicious.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, when you've got I love Indian food because of the complexity of all the spices and everything that goes in it. Sometimes you're taking a bite going like, I can't even place all these flavors.
Right.
I love it when that happens. I love it when I taste something and it makes my head spin, and I don't know what's happening, and then I have to know. Like,
right.
You've got to break it down to me. Niko was that person, and it's so funny, man. I wish that I had an archive of my interview with him because I went in so cocky. I was so confident because I just came out of doing my first bar program, and it went well. It didn't go bad. It just, I wasn't ready yet. I wasn't up to snuff. But I'm real cocky, and when I go in, you know, I'm talking myself up, and I'm saying, I do this, and I do that, and he's just looking at me, smiling, nodding, being really polite, taking it all in, but behind that smile, I imagine he's like, dude, you're going to learn so much. You're going to learn so much. And I did, and it was the same thing. It, you know, working with ingredients I'd never worked with before, not working with spirits I had never seen before.
Right.
Learning the history behind these things and understanding what makes an Amaro, what makes, they're all liqueurs, but, you know, what are we doing? Aperitifs, digestives, Amaros? I mean, there's a whole family of categories that fall below just liqueur.
Right.
And I had no idea. Amaro Nonino? I'd never seen it before.
Right. Same thing with beers. Often customers come in, they like light beers. I go, okay, you mean like light on calories? Like Modelo Oro or like Ultra? Like Michelob Ultra? Is that what you mean? Or like, do you mean like light in color?
Light in body, light in taste?
And I didn't know before I worked in this position and understood the complexities to beer. But I think that we should talk about it a little bit. For the average listener, I think that would love to know a little bit more about beer and the differences between different beers. I mean, it's interesting to think that people think it's just about the color, but it has to do with different yeast, different grains, different hop levels, blah, 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 so on mm-hmm. and so forth, right? What's a good way to break this down? Because I know it's complex. But.
So commonly people think of beers in two categories as light and dark, right? That's sort of the most common way of looking at it. And it's not far from the truth, however far it is. There really are only two types of beer. There's ales and lagers. And those are your ale yeast and your lager yeast. And then everything spurs out from those. That's where it starts getting a bit tricky, because most beers are ales. Most of them. Those were the most common styles. Lagers were just harder to do because you have to cold lager them. The yeast is a little bit finicky. And one way that it was described to me, and you know, there was a little bit of elitism when ales were really taking off, that ales were the superior beer. That well, ales are top fermenting beers, and that's where the yeast rests, and that's where it begins its fermentation problem. Where lagers are bottom fermenting beers, so when they're in the fermenting vats, that yeast is going to settle at the bottom, and that's where your fermentation takes place. So the idea was ales on top, lagers on bottom. And it's, you know, it's not true, because I mean, there's I love lagers. I love ales. I love them both. I mean, you want something crisp, clean, and refreshing, it's probably going to be a lager.
Right. Mm-hmm. This ain't pimps and hoes, though. Like, you know, pimps on top, hoes on bottom, you know what I mean? That's so funny. But so, yeah, they ferment at different temperatures, too. Mm-hmm. But, like, something that that blew my mm-hmm. mind, because I like stouts, right? Mm-hmm. And a stout is an ale. So that's what's confusing. Sometimes people are like, I like dark beers, but then if we have a stout, or I like lagers or something. Oh, what about a stout? It's like, well, technically a stout's an ale. And they're like, well, I thought it was a lager, it was a dark beer. And it's like, not necessarily.
Right.
What makes a beer dark or light?
The grain. So
the grain. In color, I'm saying. We're talking about color specifically more. So and flavor profile, I guess. It's correlated for sure.
Yeah, right? The main grain for beer is barley. And barley goes through a malting process. And it's basically where you're toasting the malt and you're toasting it to various temperatures. So I like to compare it to like toasting a slice of bread. You do a really, really light toast. You might get a little bit of like a yellowish color. Do a little bit darker. It turns a little bit more brown. You go full on, like, burn the motherfucker, you're getting black char on it. And so there's this spectrum of malts. You know, we get into, like, various types of malts, the grains, but, you know, we'll just keep it simple for now.
Right.
You're also, in that process, you're affecting color, sugars, and then flavor. That's the spectrum that you're going to get from those malts. So the lighter the toast, the lighter the color, but the higher sugar concentration. The more you cook it down, the more you're cooking out the sugars. So when you get to the really black toasted malts, that's where you're getting a lot of your roasty flavors, your coffee flavors, those dark chocolate flavors. And then you blend them with other malts to get some of those fruitier components.
Right.
You know, when you get some of those stouts that have hints of like figs or black cherries, something like that, but then it's backed with like this dark chocolate sort of thing. It's, you know, it's a really unique experience. But it's, you know, it's weirdos like me in breweries going like, what happens when we start mixing these malts? And just like making a cocktail, I'm sure they have ratios, and so they're playing right. with a certain amount. And you just start juggling some things in there. And, you know, you start with, like, a particular style, something you want to go for. And then you start playing with, okay, what's going to make this unique? What's going to make this stand out? Or are we just reinventing something that somebody else has done? Like, I love the old number 38 Irish Dry Stout from North Coast. When I tried that on Nitro, my days of drinking Guinness were over. And I've talked about this before. The Guinness that we get here in America is not imported from Ireland. To the best of my understanding, unless this has changed, it was being brewed in Canada and then imported from Canada into America. Now, the problem with that is you could use the same malt, you could use the same recipe, but you're not getting the malt from the same source. You're not getting the water from the same source. You might have the same strain of yeast. That's pretty easy to transport. But, I mean, those components make a difference in the flavor. And talk to anybody that's been to Europe or Ireland, and they'll tell you the Guinness tastes so much better there.
Because the grain comes from the island, yeah. more, right? Locally, like, I mean, mm-hmm. semi-locally, whatever, like, from the continent at least, not so much, like, they're shipping all this barley over to Canada to make it. Canada's either importing it from the States or they're growing it in Canada.
Right, right, yeah. right exactly. So it could be...
It makes a difference. The terroir, essentially, kind of, right?
Yeah. Well, and then the water is a huge component.
Yeah.
You know, they were doing a breakdown of Ardbeg.
Uh-oh. That's our meat.
Meat is complete.
No, it's not complete, but we're going to let it roll a little bit longer. We're smoking a tri-tip down while we're doing this podcast. It's Memorial Day, folks.
But that's like with spirits, you know. You turned me onto that podcast, the Bartender Podcast, and they were breaking down Ardbeg.
Uh-huh.
And a huge component of the flavor is the water that runs off the hills and settles into a peat moss bog. And something about the alkaline of the water because of the peat moss, when it goes into the distillation process, it creates a new compound called malic acid.
Okay.
And malic acid gives it this, to me, it tastes waxy. It has almost a waxy mouthfeel. But it's so integral to that flavor that if you were to make that with the exact same ingredients but sourced from another area, it's not going to be the same.
Right.
It might be similar. It's not going to be the same.
Cannabis is similar like that. Oh. Depending on the environment in which you grow the same seeds, it will grow very differently. It will genetically express itself in real time, in real reality, different than the one next to it, slightly, but definitely differentially. Like, you could tell. You look at them, you smell them, you smoke them, you could tell a difference for sure.
Yeah, I remember when I moved to Santa Cruz for a short time. Santa Cruz is such an interesting area because you have the salty seawater right next to redwoods.
Right.
It's weird.
It's beautiful. It's very strange, though. Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, people that were growing outdoor cannabis at the time, it was so unique. It was so special. You know, getting that Santa Cruz bud was, you know, it's gathering its nutrients from its environment. So you're getting some of that salty seawater in it. You're getting that redwood in it. You're getting all the microbiomes that are part of that environment are affecting the growth of that plant.
Right.
And so
same with the barley and why we're talking about this, right?
Exactly.
Same thing, same idea.
Mm-hmm. And to the water, something about that salty seawater and that bud, different. It's just different.
100%.
You take that seed and you go grow it in, I don't know, Porterville?
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot different.
For Hanford, where the water smells like eggs and it's all sulfuric and shit, like extra sulfury. Like, plant grows hella beast because it loves sulfur. Like, imagine.
Ooh, the nitrated water in Lindsay. That's got to be interesting.
Oh, shit. Yeah. You don't even need nutrients. You just fucking feed it the water and it's good to go. But yeah, so beers are so complex, man. It's so interesting because I love that at the Wake House, we provide craft beer on draft solely, pretty much, unless we have an event usually. Well, maybe we'll bring in Modelo on draft or something like that. But it's really interesting that we get to offer something new, something different, and often something creative because the brewers are being more creative, not necessarily trying to reinvent the wheel, but provide something that is unique, that stands out, that is a winner, you know? And all of them to them, I'm sure they're babies. They're all winners.
Right.
And even if they're not, I'm sure they put a good name on it to get it out the door, you know? But we get to provide something really unique. And I love that we're always just rotating out. We don't have the same ones nonstop over and over and over. Maybe we'll get the same one in again later, but we like to swap it out. It really gives you an opportunity to play with different flavor profiles. It gives me an opportunity to learn more about it, to describe to the customer, yes, but to understand beer. Because I think a lot of places, if they're just pouring Tecate, Dos Equis, Modelo, Bud Light, and Half Dome or whatever, right? Like, good beers. Not knocking these beers necessarily. I'm just saying, though, that like you don't get to learn anything about it. That's just brand preference. That's like a brand monopoly that people suggest, you know, to you. Like, it's kind of like when you go into Costco, there's only three options of ketchup, you know, or there's only one option of a three-pack of ketchup. Like, you don't really have choices. And I feel like that's kind of more limiting. And it also isn't – it's still providing a good product to the customer that wants to pay for it, but it's not necessarily letting them learn about what the differences are between the beers. It's just kind of saying, like, buy our product. That's all we want, you know?
Well, and I mean, there's people are on a spectrum as well.
Right.
You know, there's people, they like what they like. That's all they want. And good on you, man.
Right.
But then there's so many of us that are curious. And on that opposite end of the spectrum, you know, I crave a unique experience. Which is why I don't go to McDonald's, is because you go to any McDonald's, it's the same McDonald's.
Yeah.
But for somebody that's what they love and they crave, they're going to go and they're going to have a great experience every time.
It's creepy though, because we were just talking about how things are produced differently and stuff and how they possess different qualities and flavors. But if you go to a McDonald's here, you go to a McDonald's in the middle of the country, it's going to be like the same McChicken. It's kind of homogenized. It's kind of creepy when you think about it like that. Yeah, it's like, well, how did they get it to all be the same though? It's fucking weird.
They've got it. They must have a really disciplined process.
And they probably have a huge pull in the meat game, everything. Like they source probably from these huge poultry houses, these huge meat packing plants. Like they're their biggest buyer. They want a consistent product, and it's provided.
Right.
Yeah. Now, makes sense. Just
me, on the other hand, I want a unique experience. And what's great, especially about our beer program, is because craft beer has finally really taken off in the Valley, we have so many options of fantastic brewers that are local.
We do, man. We seriously do. We really do.
I mean, when I last left the Valley, you know, you've got Tioga Sequoia, you had House of Pendragon. I think Kaweah had just popped up at the time. There wasn't a lot. There wasn't. But the beers that were available were good. And, you know, the Valley's just a little bit slower to catch up with trends. But now, I mean, we've got Hop Forged. We've got, who am I missing?
Jack Rabbit Brewing. Mm-hmm. We have Barrel House is a big one in the area, right, for sure. People love. There's just endless, honestly, bro. There's a lot. Russian River.
What's the new one in Visalia that's opening up? It's opening up right next door to Barrel House. I'm gonna look this up. I don't want to be rude, but I gotta find out. And I'm just gonna new brewery in Visalia.
Yeah, I mean, there's. God, you're right. It's really expanding though in the Valley for sure.
Longshot Brewing. Oh, dude, I forgot to shout out Brew Bakers. Brew Bakers was like the original craft brewer in Visalia.
Wow.
They've been brewing beer, I mean, since I was a kid.
Wow.
Since I it's always been there. They're still doing well. I believe one of my friends is the manager there, at least according to Kate. But yeah,
Fire Chief daughter Kate.
Yeah, Brewbakers is the OG. They were the original. I think they were around before. So there was Sequoia Brewing in Fresno,
right?
And there was sort of this division and a split that led to Tioga Sequoia. Mm-hmm. But I think Brewbakers even predates them. I think. So right. It'd be like Brewbakers and Sequoia would be the originals, the right, absolute OGs. So, yeah, I think they deserve some credit and some acknowledgement for being way ahead of the craft beer game here in the Valley.
For sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. It's a beautiful phenomena. It really is. It's like how people nerd out on wine, but it's like it's even cooler. Because it's, I don't know why, it's just even cooler, I think, because it's, everybody drinks beer. For some reason, something culturally, not everyone drinks wine on a regular basis. I'm not trying to generalize, I just feel like
right,
it's more of like an occasional thing, or there's the people that's their shit, but most people, they drink beer. I see it at the Wake House. There's some, you know, nice looking lady that you think, oh, for sure she's going to want like a white wine or something with her fish and chips. She's like, no, I want a hazy IPA. You know, it's like, all right.
Hell yeah, you do.
I'll get that for you right now, I promise.
Yeah, I used to kind of, I don't want to say shit on wine. It was just, I was such a beer elitist that what I would say is that I believe beer was more complex than wine, because wine, you're basically just taking two ingredients and getting some varietals, but for the most part, you're getting wine.
Right.
Beer, you just go with the four key ingredients, water, barley, hops, yeast, and you can produce the widest spectrum of flavors,
right,
tonalities, everything from like something really crisp and light and easy drinking to the heaviest stout that you could stand a spoon in, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so cool knowing that you have this whole spectrum of flavors and colors from just four ingredients.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. To me, I find that fascinating. I just think it's so cool.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really is. I'm glad we talked about it. I'm glad we discussed it.
What's going down, podcast listener? I imagine that you drive a car when you're out and aboutin'. You might even have a motorcycle, per se. And I think that most people that live in the society we live in have a home of some sort. On those things, do you have insurance? That is my question to you. And if you do not, it seems like it's time to get you some. What are you doing out there listening to a podcast? Because if you are, at the same time simultaneously, you could be calling Alfredo Vargas over at Academy West Insurance to provide you with top-notch service. Give him a call at 559-638-3800. Do you not have a license? That doesn't seem to be a problem. He can set you up. Do I know how? I have no idea, but he can set you up. He claims to know. Are you anything like me? And when you were younger, got into some trouble, had a DUI, and needed an SR-22 insurance? Maybe? I hope not. But if you do, Alfredo Vargas over at Academy West Insurance can set you up with the free SR-22. You can find Alfredo looking sharp in the suit on 998 North Manning Avenue in Reedley, California, or you can give him a jingle down there at the shop at 559-638-3800. Be sure to tell him that you heard about him on the Symbiosis Now podcast, and he will set you up ASAP with all your insuring needs. Thank you, Alfredo, for sponsoring the podcast. And now let's get back to the show, folks.
I want to kind of jump into some random bar knowledge, facts, myths, and legends for you to expose for the people.
All right, test me.
Because I feel like there's something that sometimes comes up. People order a dirty martini, an extra dirty martini with olives. A fucking, what's an extra? What's the dirtiest one with the pickle juice? What'd they call it?
Oh, what? Yeah, oh, that.
Extra, super dirty, or like the dirty pickle or something. Pickle martini or some shit like that, right? It's the dirtiest of my days.
Maybe it was the dirtiest martini.
But I come to learn from the man, the myth, the legend, Sean Patterson, you, that a martini is stirred on ice. It's diluted with water slightly and maybe some olive juice if they want it dirty, right? That's what makes it dirty, essentially. But why do people say it's shaken, not stirred? This is James Bond quote, right? What's up with that shit?
So the James Bond was a tongue-in-cheek joke to the martini, because originally the martini was made with gin. It was always stirred. So the joke was, I'll have a vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. So basically, like, doing the whole thing wrong. That was the joke. It was a joke.
Edgy, too, like, because he's edgy, right? He does shit that's different.
Yeah, he's James Bond. Yeah. He does it his way.
Yeah.
But, but that became a trend. It absolutely became a trend. And it's not bad. It's just different. You know, it's not that there's a wrong way to make a martini.
Right.
It's going to come down to preference. And the reason I prefer to stir a martini, and we can get into, you know, dry martinis, extra dry martinis as well, is you're doing a few things. So like you said, we're going to create a little bit of dilution on there. So you're taking some of the heat off the alcohol. But like if you've ever put a bottle of vodka in your freezer, it gets kind of thick.
Right.
So now you've got this new mouthfeel. So we're going to pack it with as much ice as we can because we want to get it as cold as possible. Because in addition to smoothing out the alcohol, we want to get like this silky mouthfeel, that's almost creamy. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a beautiful thing that happens with both vodka and gin. When you sort of chill out that heat, it opens up those sugars. Yeah. And that's why, like, if I'm going to do a vodka martini, I prefer to use Goose. It's just delicious. It's like those sugars come out, the sweetness comes out. But that gets into like the dry martini or the extra dry martini. I feel like some of that terminology has been kind of mixed up or confused over the years because some people believe that an extra dry martini is just vodka or just gin, when really it's the addition of vermouth. So a dry martini would be like rinsing the glass with a vermouth, discarding the excess, and then pouring it in there. And it's just going to add another element. You know, a vermouth's a type of wine. So you're going to get a little bit more sugars, but they're going to be dry sugars. Some people have described it as tasting like a boot.
Okay.
So extra dry would be the addition of more vermouth. And, you know, for somebody that likes that dry sort of bitter flavor, you know, you do it extra dry. Not just straight vodka or just straight gin.
Right, like it would be, maybe you're saying that culturally sometimes it's thought of as meaning like you do like a double of vodka or something to make it real hot and not stir it maybe as long. So it's more just vodka, like extra dry would maybe normally say like dry, meaning more alcohol or tasting more high in alcohol, really.
Yeah, maybe maybe they're wanting more of the heat from the alcohol.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure, but I mean...
But if you get to talk to the person and you get to specify, Right. Not just seeing a ticket print out at the printer or something, being a bartender, like server puts in a ticket and you got to make the drink and they take it to the table. You didn't get to have the interaction and ask, well, what exactly do you look for in your martini? How do you like it done? But if you do and they come to the bar, then you can make it however they prefer. And however exactly. they prefer, if they call it extra dry, well, what is your version of extra dry? And then they let you know and you're like, okay, I'll make it just like that.
Well, and it's so funny because like a martini is such a simple drink, but it's a complex order.
Uh-huh.
You know, because if somebody was to say, I'll have a Hendrix martini. There's a lot of qualifying questions that go into that. One, do you want this dry, extra dry, or straight up? Do you like this with an olive or a twist? And do you prefer this shaken or stirred?
Right.
Usually I don't even offer a shaken option. I'm going to stir it. But somebody that really knows, they'll ask you for, you know, so here would be a full martini order for, not me, but somebody. I know there's people that like this. It would be a goose martini straight up shaken with an ice pond and a twist. I personally can't stand an ice pond on top of my martini.
So that's like ice chips?
Yes.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
So not double straining something after you shake it?
Would exactly. be
able, right?
Yeah. So you just pour it straight in there, get some of those ice chips. Some people like the crunch of it.
Okay.
Me, it throws it off for me, mm-hmm. again, because I like it stirred. I like that silky, almost creamy mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, you shake, you're diluting it even more than if you're stirring because you're adding a lot more friction to it.
Right.
And then you also get this cloudy color. And I don't want it to be cloudy. I want it to be completely transparent. Right. I want to look right through it.
Right.
And if there's anything obscuring that, you know, a little lemon expression, you get some of those essential oils on top. Just beautiful. Oh, yeah. I'll take one.
Some Laphroaig, some scotch.
Yeah, single malt Islay.
So, espresso martini, though, is shaken. That's how we do it, for sure. There's other martinis, right? There's a variation on these, right? And I don't really need to get into it, but I'm glad you cleared that up because it's something that sometimes people joke about. I'm like, what do they even mean? I never really watched James Bond, mm-hmm. but it's important to, like, I don't know, enlighten the listener that generally it's a stirred thing. But if you want something a certain way, you got to know. You got to try it. You got to talk to your bartender and see what they can do with it, you know, mm-hmm. and see what those things mean so you can develop maybe a profile that you're going after, you know. Something happened the other night where this gentleman came in and he wanted to buy his friend. His birthday was at midnight. He's turning 21. He wants to buy a shot, bro. I'm going to buy him a shot for 21. And you told him that, man, it has to be past 6 a.m. on his birthday to be served alcohol. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. That's a thing.
Yeah.
Huh?
Well, a big thing in being in bars, being in restaurants, and even just being a vendor like a convenience store or a grocery store is anybody that's selling alcohol has to stay updated on their local laws, every 3 to 5 years, depending on what kind of certificate that you get or what position that you have. And, you know, most people don't take these programs. And these classes are boring and they're dull, but it's essential. You have to know the laws, and laws do change. Hence the reason you have to get your certification done every 3 to 5 years, because what's changed in those 3 to 5 years?
Right.
And since the average person doesn't take these courses, and one, they're not aware of the laws, and two, they're not aware of the repercussions of these laws, they don't realize how much a server, a vendor, a bartender has on the line to adhere to these laws. In a way, it's kind of screwed up because, you know, we're not law enforcement, but we're put into a position to where we have to enforce a law.
Right.
It's weird.
It is weird.
It's weird. And especially when all the repercussions are stacked against the server, the vendor, the contributor, it's not fair. It's not fair to us.
I don't think so at all. If someone wants to get all fucked up and act out of line and do that, they could do that from anywhere. They could buy booze from anywhere. They could get their hands on booze somehow and do something wrong, and it would somehow come back on the person that sold them it. You know, say right. if they're underage, right, for example, mm-hmm. or something. You know, even though it's like that kid was being a shithead, he had a fake ID or whatever. He stole the booze. I don't fucking know. He, you know, the point is like somehow it comes back on the provider. And that's what's really strange sometimes.
But there's also, you know, and courses will talk about, this is a legal term called due diligence. Mm-hmm. And due diligence is when you've done your very best to adhere to every standard of service, every law that's in place, and something squeaks by. You know, for example, that night, that person brought a beer in. It's illegal to bring a beer into a bar.
Right.
You can't do that. So I throw the beer away. Well, then when the guy started being aggressive and he looked like he was going to get violent, I started thinking, well, I'll give him this beer back. He can go on his way. It's his property, and he's leaving. Now, it's illegal for me to do that. But if I'm threatened with violence, if I feel that my safety or the safety of my guests is in question, then I'm going to do everything that I can to remove this person so it doesn't escalate to violence.
Right, exactly.
So if I'm sitting in a court of law and I say, I'm doing my due diligence to keep myself and my patron safe, that's an acceptable defense.
Right.
It's a legal defense.
Right.
So sometimes you have to just use your due diligence. You have to use your best judgment in a situation, and you have to look at not just their safety, but the safety of the majority. You know, is this guy going to turn into a problem and hurt somebody in the bar? He's clearly directing his aggression at me. I'm not a fighter. I don't want to fight this guy.
Right.
I don't want it to come to that at all.
Fuck no, bro.
I just rather that he go on, have a great night, and I can do the same.
Some of the hardest shit is to cut someone off. Right. Because you don't want it to even get to that point. You know, as a server, you just don't. You know, mm-hmm. like you don't want to overserve someone. That's not the goal. I always felt like if you want to get smashed, go home and do that shit. Or mm-hmm. like go out to a club type atmosphere where that's sanctioned, kind of. You have an Uber driver, you know what I mean? Whatever. And you're taking full responsibility for your shit, you know? Right. But when someone's getting too turnt and then it escalates to the point where it's like, hey, man, you're yelling at the customers, yelling at me. You know, you need to quiet down. Then they get aggressive. It's like, hey, man, look, here's some water. Then they're like, what the fuck? I'm not drinking this fucking water. Give me another fucking beer. Like, it's like, uh-oh, what's going on here? And you have to somehow keep yourself cool, calm, and collective and let right. them know it's not going to happen, bro. But I got you chips. I got you food. I got whatever I can. Mm-hmm. I got water for you, whatever. Let's come down. Let's drink another cup of water. We'll talk about that next beer. You know what I mean? Things like that. But to cut someone off abruptly, they're going to get mad, especially if they have alcohol in their system and they want to pay for more product. They're like, well, I'm paying. It's like, yeah, that's not the point, though. You know, you're in a public setting. You're being a nuisance kind of at this point. No one likes that. I don't know how else to say it. Nobody fucking likes that.
Well, and I mean, there's a variety of types of places. And there's places that are rowdy and they love the rowdy people. There's places I prefer the, you know, restaurant loungy atmosphere. I like a relaxed vibe. That's not to say that if there's a concert or even if it's not an event, it's just a busy night and everybody's happy and everything's awesome. Like, no, that's great news. That's good for us. That's good for them. That means they're having fun. We're making money. Win-win. Let's do it. But then there's like nightclubs. And nightclubs is a whole different beast. And there's people that are really good at that. I am not one of those people. That's not my environment. I've worked a few. I worked one in Hollywood that I really, really loved. It was a lot of fun. But also, I was younger, and I was into that party scene at the time. I was going to work to get high and get fucked up.
Yeah.
And make some money. It was great.
I bet.
But, you know, now that I'm in my 40s, it just doesn't sound appealing to me anymore.
Now we're doing some real honest work, bro. Yeah. That's what we're doing, you know.
Then I'll go home and get fucked up.
Yeah, hell yeah. You told me recently about when you went out to the Modernist in Fresno. Mm-hmm. It was a real nice place. They had a good cocktail program.
Great cocktail program.
Yeah. But you told me that you were talking, you were ordering cool shit that, like, only a bartender would order that knows drinks really well. And the bartender was like, how the fuck do you order some shit like this and not be a bartender? And you're like, I am a bartender. And she did the bartender's handshake with you.
Oh, right? Yeah. I remember you wanted to talk about
what this. What is this bartender's handshake?
You know what? I wish I knew the history on it. I wish I knew where that actually started. But to me, I learned about it probably 2015, I think. 2015, something like that. I was working at Frank's Place in Fresno, which is connected to the Warner's Theater.
Okay.
And we had a bottle of Fernet Bianca. And Fernet, it's not the best tasting liqueur. You know, it's a digestif. It's something that you would have like after a meal, something that kind of relax you and settle you after you've eaten and, you know, you're being social. It's just become common bartender courtesy. Like if you're serving a bartender and you have Fernet, you find out they're a bartender, offer them a shot of Fernet. And it's called a bartender's handshake. And that night that I was there, it's kind of douchey, but one, I did want to test the bartenders because I was looking at the program and I was looking at their execution of every drink, and it's like watching an orchestra. It's like this symphony, and it's just beautiful. Everything is timed. Everything has a place, and everything just flows.
They're playing a harmony together.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's beautiful to watch. It's just it's gorgeous, and so I, like I said, it's kind of douchey, but I wanted to test their knowledge a little bit, but with, you know, some slightly obscure drinks that I really enjoy.
Right.
And like, I think the first one that I ordered was a Boulevardier with Basil Hayden's, which isn't that obscure. You know, it's basically a Negroni, but with bourbon. Mm-hmm. And it was perfect, in my opinion, perfect. I watched their pours, and they pour it the same way I do. And I love that balance. I love that balance of two ounces of whiskey, 3/4 ounce Campari, 3/4 ounce sweet vermouth with that orange expression on a large rock format. Elegant, just elegant. Then to have fun and test the water, I asked her for a black Manhattan. And a black man, well, you know a Manhattan.
Right.
So if you substitute the vermouth with Chenar, then you've got a black Manhattan. And I was just curious, will she know?
And will they have Chenar?
Well, they have
we Chenar. Don't at the bar, right?
No,
yeah,
we don't.
Right.
No, so when I ordered it, she was like, yeah, sure. And she started to walk away. And then she comes back real quick and she kind of looks at me, you know, with the hawk eye. She's like, are you a bartender? I was like, yeah. She's like, cool. She takes off, makes the drink, comes back with the drink and a shot of Fernet. I was like, dude, you're awesome.
She knows her shit.
She knows what's up.
Fuck. Yeah.
Really rad. So, yeah, they have a just top-notch cocktail program. Absolutely great.
Good question. Broad question. Maybe there's not an answer for this question, but do you have a favorite drink or cocktail, and what is it?
I go through phases and cycles like I do with beer. You know, it's the same thing. I guess my go-to beer is obviously some type of IPA. I prefer like a West Coast style. That's my favorite. Cocktail, I usually go for a Boulevardier. Usually that's my first one. And if they can execute a Boulevardier, then I like to take some chances. I personally don't really go for citrusy, fruity things. And that's not to say like because they're sweeter. It's so funny. You know this, like people when they say like, oh, I like something fruity, generally what they're saying is they want something sweet.
Right.
But you know, like we make a Bramble. And it's basically a sour with some muddled blackberries in it. It's not over-the-top sweet. It's got a nice balance to it. And that color, the aroma, everything, right. It's a beautiful drink. But it's not really my go-to, you know.
Right.
I guess I just like spirits stacked on top of other liqueurs and other wines. And just give me a glass of booze. Let's cut to the chase here.
Yeah, I'm kind of basic. I feel like when I'll make all these crazy drinks, bro. I'll make lemon drop, old-fashioned. Fucking jumping over here to make all these crazy drinks all night long. And then I'll come home and I'll be like, I think I'm going to take a shot of Proper 12. Just all basic, yeah, simple, right? $20 bottle of fucking booze. Just take shots. Don't need to mix it in anything.
How hard do you want to work after you get off of work?
Yeah, right, yeah. But I'll come home. I'll make Allison like a Di Serrano sour or something with the egg white. Shake it up all crazy. You know, make it beautiful.
And isn't that funny? Like, I totally prefer to make something a little more difficult for other people. I don't know. I like that wow factor. I like to impress them. I always wanted to be a rock star, and now I have to do it from behind the bar.
Yeah.
I want the attention.
Hell yeah.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah. And you get it, bro. Mm-hmm. You know, you're really good, like, maybe you're not a show, like, you're not super showy, like, throwing bottles around and all this crazy shit.
Right.
But you do have, you command a presence, man. People know you're a fucking bartender. Like, they come in, and, like, once you start talking, they're like, okay, this guy fucking knows his shit. I can shout out Rico, bro. He comes in and's, like, telling Sean, he's telling customers, this guy's a fucking genius. He's all excited because he knows he can make pretty much whatever you'd ask him right now within our capabilities, as long as we have the booze to make
he's
it.
He's always Snapchatting. I love it, dude.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Shout out Rico, dude. You're the fucking man.
Rico, you're the man.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. But that midnight espresso, I'm Oh, God, I could drink that all day.
It's something that's new nice. That we put on the menu or on the board at the Wake House. Something new that we came across. Sean got sent a video, right? So you didn't recreate the wheel here like we were talking about earlier, but you implemented an idea at the Wake House that is, I feel like, a great idea because people often love an espresso martini. It's a hot drink. It's a TikTok phenomena too. Like over the last couple of years, people are like always talking about espresso martinis, espresso drinks, right? Yeah. This is another one to add to the repertoire. I think it's really phenomenal too.
Well, so yeah, I got sent that video and we'll just kind of break it down for people.
Yeah.
Super simple infusion. And an infusion is when you take a spirit and you just add anything to it. It could be fruit. It could be an herb. It could be a spice. In this case, we infuse some Breckenridge bourbon with a Bold and Brew coffee. And the video said you only need to infuse it for 2 minutes. I give it about 5 minutes, and I've done infusions in the past and done them wrong. And if you over infuse something, it sucks.
It's
really bad. I've left rosemary and whiskey for months, and then gone back, and it's like, oh, bro, it's undrinkable. It's so bad. So you know, an infusion doesn't have to take a long time. So we infuse it for about 5 minutes, and then they did the. So he did simple syrup in his. We do Demerara in ours, and I like the Demerara one because it's just a richer flavor, but also it's darker, so it complements the color of the whiskey.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
Absolutely.
And then his final move was to flame that espresso bean and throw it right on top. Oh, I believe he did an orange expression as well. I don't remember, but whether he did or not, we do. But then I'm trying it just the way this person did it, like just the whiskey and the coffee, it just begged for a hint of vanilla. Just a hint, you know, not too much and not like a vanilla syrup, like we gotta make it sweet. But that's why I took that little spray bottle and just a little spritz right on top. Dude, that vanilla with that freshly flame roasted espresso bean, with that espresso, with the whiskey, with that orange expression. I mean, you've got like that orange creamsicle, but with coffee and
all chocolate. On a nice rock format. Oh
yeah, dude. It's just, oh man, it smells so good. I could drink that all day long.
Absolutely bro. Absolutely. I think it's a big hit already for sure. We created it like a week ago. You made this like less than a week ago, and it, boom, all week long, people have been like, what is that? Like, you know, what do you mean? Oh, espresso, midnight espresso, old fashioned. What are you talking about? You know, people that like to try something new too, like you said, you know, people that like old fashions. Easily be like, hey, how about the midnight espresso old fashioned? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not heavy on espresso in the sense of a lot of caffeine. I feel like an espresso martini probably has just a little more, given that we're adding literal ounce of espresso to the drink.
100%.
In comparison to this infusion, where we're taking some beautiful espresso beans roasted by Bold Brew coffee, right?
Bold and Brew
mm-hmm. coffee.
We need to find out where they're from.
Yeah, we
do. Shout them out.
Yeah, shout out to Bold and Brew Coffee. Check them out. They got the bombest espresso beans, dude. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure plenty other beans, too. But we use their espresso beans at the bar. And just a slight infusion for what, 10, 15 minutes soaking in the bourbon?
Five.
And it takes on these caramel, chocolatey notes. If you smell the bottle, come by. We'll let you smell the bottle, maybe. You know,
yeah.
It's amazing. And then you make an old fashioned out of it. It basically is the bitters implemented into the bourbon too, given that we don't add bitters because it would kind of almost be too much bitter. The espresso beans bring that natural bitter component to 100%. The drink, which is amazing.
Yeah, and I feel like you hit the nail on the head. That espresso brings that extra layer, that pop, that wow factor.
Yes.
There's a book called The Flavor Bible, and they kind of talk you through cocktails and dishes, and you know, you get sort of like this base recipe, but then it always asks for what's that X factor? What's that X factor flavor?
Right.
What's that thing that takes it from ordinary to extraordinary?
Right.
To be cheesy.
Right.
But it's true. And that's why, like, when I got that, first I saw it and I was like, dude, we have to taste this. We tasted it. We're like, this is great. But it's like, okay, we already have that X factor from the espresso. What's another X factor? Vanilla. Low-hanging fruit, it's right there. Like, how many times have you had a vanilla coffee of some type? Or there's been a bean that has some sort of vanilla component.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I like to find, and that's why I love that drink, is it seems like it's got multiple X factors to it. And to add the bitters to it, now you've got like sort of this allspice flavor, and it's adding sort of a Christmassy thing to it, which might work
later down the road, maybe. When the season comes, maybe.
But I feel like now we're just stacking too much on top of each other.
Right.
You know.
Right.
When we were in the recording studio, you know, you do a lot of layers when you're creating songs, and you do these layers so that when you get into the mixing process, you know, we're wearing headphones. You want to have this very wide spatial sound, so it feels like it's filling up all the area in the room.
Right.
Sometimes we had a saying that you can overdo it. You can put in too many layers, and we called it overstuffing the turkey.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
And too much going on, man, sometimes it's just not good.
Right. And that's where you start playing with flavors and flavor combinations, and that's why I love working with Chef. Because she's got great ideas for flavor combinations.
Shout out Chef Monica Torres. I forget what episode it was. I'm going to find out right now. Yeah, but she was on the podcast. You got to check her out.
I feel, dude, I'm so behind. I'm going to listen to that on the drive home.
Yeah, Chef Monica Torres, folks, out at the Wake House. She's killing it. She's been on the news. Sean's been on the news. What the fuck? I can't find what episode it was.
But. Yeah, you can see my big dumb face smiling into the camera.
But long story short, folks, you guys got to come see us out at the Wake House. We're killing it out there. We're making beautiful cocktails. We're serving beautiful beers. We're serving amazing food. And I'm not just saying that. The food's off the chain. We're doing it out there. We're making a name for it, dude. We're having shows. We got upcoming bands playing out there. We got the water that's coming up to take us under. We're celebrating the flood, baby. You know, come through. Check us out. Check Sean Patterson out because he's the man. And he'll definitely be more than hospitable towards you, no matter who you are, how you look, anything. He's going to take good care of you. He's just a real open guy. And I'm really blessed to be able to work with you, bro, because you have this very beautiful demeanor about yourself. You've definitely done things in your life. Anybody can just tell. But also that you're so, like, kind. You give people a chance no matter what. You give them multiple chances. Because I've seen you treat people that, like, kind of deserve to be told shut up. And you're just like, nah, man, everything's cool. You're a real cool guy, bro. And honestly, the epitome of what I feel like a normal human being would kind of be aspiring to be, you know?
It's fucking cool. Man. Thank you. I think we should also talk up the clarified milk punch.
Let's talk it.
Yeah, well, I don't want people to be scared to taste it. Try it. Taste it. Smell it. It's delicious.
The clarified tropical punch.
Clarified tropical punch. Guys, I labored on this for 2 weeks, putting it together. I believe in this cocktail. It is so good. It's an old traditional European drink called a clarified milk punch, where you use milk and lime juice to create a chemical reaction that causes the milk to curdle. And though it looks terrible at first, once you add your spirits and everything to it, you're going to run it through a filtration process. The reason you want that milk to clarify is to separate the caseins, the fats, and the proteins, so they create another filtration process. And when all of the spirits and everything runs through it, it's going to come out clarified. It has this slight yellow hue, but it's completely transparent, and it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. Very little added sugar. I think most of the sweetness and the body of it, which is so silky and so smooth, is the residual lactose sugars from the milk. But at the end of it, it's not a new distilled spirit. It's not a new fermentation process. This isn't Pruno. It's just a lot of rum. And some pineapple juice, some lime juice, and some coconut water. Dude, we got a party. Let's do this. Let's drink it. Come on, guys.
Yeah, dude. Seriously, you got to come check it out. It's beautiful. It's on a rock. It has a little fake orchid. It's a real orchid.
It's a real
edible
orchid.
Yeah, on top of that shit.
It's a Thai orchid from Thailand.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful drink. It's very easy to drink. Anybody that Sean has given a taste or two, they're like, does it have booze in it? And that's their first question almost every time. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's got a lot of booze in it, actually. Oh, yeah.
It drinks so easy. It's so smooth.
Yes.
So just, I mean, perfect summer drink.
Total summertime vibes, dude.
It's
for sure.
Fun in the sun tropical drink that when you sip it, you're going to picture your toes in the sand and the breeze on your face, the water crashing in front of you. I mean, it's going to take you to the beaches of Hawaii. I guarantee it.
And we got water coming up to our door at the Wake House, so definitely a drink to try out while we got the water up to the door.
Do it. You won't.
Hell yeah, you will. Because we know you will. Sean, dude, thank you, man. It's been a pleasure. I'm really grateful that we got to do this in person.
Me too. No, I'm glad that you held out. We got to do this in person. It just wouldn't be the same over the phone. And thank you for bringing me into your home, into your studio. You're the best, Tyler, man. I'm so grateful to work with you. I really am. Thank you.
Likewise, bro. Seriously. People, come check us out at the Wake House.
This podcast was created by the Symbiosis Now Network and can be found on Instagram for clips, highlights, videos, blah, 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 at symbiosis.now.network. And you can listen to the Symbiosis Now podcast as well as the Cali Ag podcast on Spotify, Apple, and all the platforms. Listener, be sure to tell your friends about the Symbiosis Now Network.